Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian news and commentary podcast that will never break the supply chain. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy Indigenous Columbus Italian Heritage / National Coming Out Day.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
We're going to talk about all of the just weirdness in the economy here in a moment. But first, the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs offers three fully funded graduate degree programs that provide students with a policy toolkit and sound understanding of the disciplines that shape public policies. Princeton School of Public and International Affairs community is bound together by a commitment to serving the public good. To learn more about the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, visit spia.princeton.edu. That's S-P-I-A dot Princeton. You'll have to know how to spell that. Dot edu. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Two of us on this podcast, you'll have to guess which ones, are old enough to remember this time in the 1970s, or a couple times in the 1970s, where in order to get your car filled with gas, you would have to go into a super long line. Sometimes it depended on what day of the week, depending on the number on your license plate at the end. It was completely bizarre. And if you turned on your RCA television there, the advertisements for cars were all about how many miles you could drive before you had to wait in these really long and bizarre gas lines that were everywhere for a while, and then they disappeared. I bring all of this up because it was weird. It was just weird, and like, people can't imagine what it's like to live in that weirdness. And I have this very unscientific sense that we are living through an economic weirdness right now. And here's my supporting evidence for this very important theory, is that there are huge traffic jams of container ships all over the coast of California, just gigantic. There's piles of those boxes there that truckers can't, there's no truckers to put the, get the containers. There's like there's a traffic jam of railroads in Joliet, Illinois, that's 25 miles long. The Rite Aids and the CVSs don't have stuff in them. There's like gangs of shoplifters going on there. The labor secretary.
Don't forget the Wolfen, Matt. I think the Wolfen are being spotted in cities above the frost line.
It's Wolfen, as they said. The big jobs report last week, Marty Walsh, the labor secretary, came out and he's completely flummoxed. How come there were only 194,000 jobs created in September? Inflation higher than we've seen in a generation. Cryptocurrencies are zooming. So Nick is finally rich. California just mandated gender-neutral toy aisles. It's just weird, is what I'm saying. So Peter, did we enter a wormhole into the 1970s, or what the hell is going on?
Yeah, you're right. The economy is weird. It's unsettled, and I think it kind of reminds me of the Avengers. For real. I've been thinking about this. It's kind of.
Hey, yep. Peter, it's I need like to go Thanos take snap. Another dose before I listen to this.
We're in it now, Nick. We're in it now. So it's like the Thanos snap. And so for the non-Marvel heads out there, at the end of Avengers Infinity War, Thanos snaps his fingers and exterminates half of all life in the universe. And that's sort of what happened to both the U.S. and global economies last year, except instead of extinguishing all life, the pandemic, and then the policy choices made around it, extinguished something like half the economy. And then, you know, at the a year or so later, the Avengers defeated Thanos and everyone came back. And when people came back, right, we saw this in WandaVision, it was super chaotic. And the same thing is happening with the economy. Turning it back on turns out to be a really, really messy endeavor. So a bunch of stuff that you mentioned, as we saw in the jobs report last week, job growth is just anemic. If anything, it's going in the wrong direction, right? There were fewer than 200,000 jobs created in September. That was way below expectations and also way below August, which was itself below expectations. The U.S. economy is still down about 5 million jobs since February 2020. You mentioned inflation, the shortage in supply chain issues, you know, most prominently with semiconductors. Basically, manufacturers can't get computer chips right now, which is why new car lots are just bizarrely empty. If you have been to shopping for a brand new car, you will find lots that can hold 600 cars that have maybe 40 cars on them, as I discovered in the last few weeks. And so, relatedly,
it's weird.
Used car prices are through the roof, and that makes sense. If you can't get a new car, people are going to bid up the used cars. And also, you can't buy a PlayStation 5, except on the secondary market. There's just, like, it's almost impossible to get one. And then there are kinks in the food market, too, right? And meat in particular has become more expensive. And this is my favorite one from the past couple of months. There's a chicken wing shortage right now, which hits me really hard, if you know me at all, right? And it's so bad that Wingstop, the restaurant devoted to chicken wings, has temporarily opened a pop-up where they've changed their name to Thighstop, because Wingstop,
I'm not
making this up at all, Wingstop cannot get chicken wings. And so that's where we're at. Thanks to the pandemic and pandemic policy choices, we had the economic equivalent of a Thanos snap. And now a year and a half later, employers can't fill jobs. You can't buy a car or a PlayStation or chicken wings, and everything is weird.
The real question, though, is why, given that Thanos killed half the people in the Marvel Universe and probably more than half the people who want to be in movie theaters, but why does Jeremy Renner's Hawkeye persist?
Because you got to have a Christmas special. That's basically if they're going to do it like an 80s style, you know, like Lethal Weapon and
the Schwarzenegger Christmas special.
It's going to be a Christmas movie, except a Marvel Christmas
telling
movie.
Telling you, you find that Schwarzenegger Christmas special with Danny DeVito
and also not a
and,
movie.
Mike Tyson, Special Olympic athletes, and Miss Barbara Mandrell.
So look, Hawkeye is the chicken thighs of the Marvel universe. When you don't have the main characters around,
Schwarzenegger Christmas special.
When the stuff that people want is not available, you deliver them the secondary product, and that turns out to be chicken thighs.
Catherine, there's a lot of socialist kids out there who are dunking on late capitalism because your boyfriend Elon Musk Bezos didn't supply the shelves in CVS. What say you, robot gal? Did capitalism fail us?
I mean, capitalism is always failing us and then trying to make it up to us, which is one of the great things about capitalism. But no, I actually, the next issue of Reason Magazine is in honor of the 30th anniversary of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And one thing that working on that issue has reminded me is if you think supply chains are a little weird right now, allow me to introduce you to all of the alternatives, but especially centrally planned and managed alternatives. And I know that the cool kids these days with the democratic socialisms somehow think that they're not going to centrally plan the economy, but still do the democratic socialisms or whatever. But that is not what will happen. And, you know, this supply chain is the worst chain except for all the others, I think. So, yes, things are pretty tricky right now. I am wary a bit of, you know, getting too far in on the hype on this. I mean, Matt just told us a very dramatic story. And it was a story where each of the sentences in it was true, but does it quite add up to OMG, the system is in danger,
Ragnarok,
everything is bad, Ragnarok.
To keep it in the Marvel universe.
To keep it in the Marvel universe. And, you know, maybe it does. And I do not want to be, you know, pathologically Pollyanna-ish, which is a great temptation for me, and say like, you know what, actually, the things that seem bad might not be that bad and it's all going to work out. But I do think what Suderman just described is right. And a big part of what is going on with our supply chains is not supply, but demand. The demand was what was really, really weird, in addition to some of these things that affected our labor supply and other, you know, important parts of the system. So
Reason for that is that we made a policy choice to keep people's bank accounts full. And so
correct.
People, especially the middle class and the lower middle class, their balance sheets are, again, not to every single human, but are on average just much
better.
People
than
have more money
been.
In the bank after 2020. And that is one of the things that is driving this weirdness.
I'm going
right.
to.
And we made policy choices to make it much, much harder to consume services. So, I mean, people were already going to have reduced their consumption of services because they were rightly scared of getting sick. But we made more policy choices that made it even harder to consume services by shuttering restaurants and other types of retail businesses or and other types of service businesses, which means that people shifted their consumption to stuff. And so I think, you know, it is many players in the market looked at the, you know, reduced demand at the very beginning of the pandemic and reasonably guessed that that demand might stay low for many, many types of goods and services. And that it that did not play out exactly as it might have played out if there had been no or different government intervention. And that is,
I would add that one thing is, like, I'm going to get worried about thigh stop. When thigh stop turns into neck and gizzard stop, that's when you hit the alarm. Okay.
I mean, that's basically, as far as I can tell, what it was like to live in Moscow. It was like, it was neck and gizzard stop for, you know,
if you were lucky.
Like real, yeah. real deal in the, you know, in the 60s and 70s.
The reason I bring that up is that the chicken wing shortage story is actually something, if you lived in the Midwest, you encountered basically about once every 18 to 24 months over the past couple of decades, because for various reasons, the supply and demand gets out of whack. And you hear these stories about how it's actually cheaper to buy chicken breasts than it is to buy chicken wings, et cetera. It doesn't mean we're not going through a crunch now, but a lot of this stuff is actually long-term kind of restructurings of the economy that started closer to 2000. And I'm thinking particularly about, like, the labor force issues. One of the things that's interesting, whatever you say about the unemployment rate, and of course, even with a crappy jobs report, the unemployment numbers went down because fewer people are looking for jobs. When you look at the labor force participation rate, it peaked basically around 2000 at 67%. In March 2020, it was at 63%. So it was already, you know, after the economic crisis and a full recovery and a long, slow economy that was growing at least 1% for a decade. We had the longest expansion, uninterrupted expansion in, you know, in American history. And the labor force participation rate was 4 percentage points lower than it was in 2000. And now it's at 62%. So, you know, keep these things in mind, because the biggest problem actually, or one of the biggest problems with the COVID, the onslaught of COVID was a crisis mentality where everybody shit their pants. We should be careful about doing that now, because things are not good. I agree that they're weird, and there are, you know, it is more than passingly strange when you go to CVS and you look in, like, for Quest bars, you know, the meal replacement bar, and they are not there. You know, by the same token, you can get them overnight on Amazon at a better price. So it's like there's some weird stuff going on. There's still a lot of long-term restructuring, and I think, you know, that the big thing is not to get caught up in a crisis.
Mom. On the jobs issue, I think that's sort of important to highlight, because there's a real issue with burnout, and it's led to a phenomenon that's been called the Great Resignation. And you see this in healthcare and tech in particular. But, you know, employers are raising pay. The wages are actually up right now, and they still can't find the workers. And so part of the Thanos snap was that people in all walks of life experienced totally different lifestyles for an extended period of time and have had what some have termed pandemic epiphanies, where they just have realized they don't want to live life the way they were beforehand.
They don't want to work.
Right?
Partly because their bank accounts were being padded by the government in unprecedented ways, which, you know, I don't know about you guys, but, like, I get a lot of meaning out of the work that I do. And if I could make 80% of the same salary and never talk to you guys again, I might take that.
Well, we all
worked
through the pandemic
here,
right?
You would top
me off. But yes, policy has subsidized that indecision and that uncertainty to some extent because of the various payments that were made that kept people's bank accounts full. And so I just think that this is going to have some long-term ramifications here, as Nick said, that started in some ways before the pandemic. But in some industries, it's just going to mean labor supply issues, at least for the near term. And in others, it's going to mean a lot more work from home and flexible schedules. And you already see a lot of kind of labor negotiation over scheduling and sort of how, you know, how committed people are going to be to work, because people, like I said, went through something that was pretty unprecedented in at least in modern history, where everyone just sort of stayed home for at least 6 or 8 weeks, and in many cases for a year or longer.
There's a big issue about labor force participation, and again, you know, looking at the long term trends, you could actually read it as a major success that fewer people have to work. And, you know, for the economy to function, and, you know, and we're doing better. Generally speaking, people are doing better. I think there's a bunch of mismatches that, again, there's the short term ones. And like, you know, it would be, I've tried to find like clear distillations of how much of people not working or working part time is due to school issues. Because if you have kids this fall, like, you know, when we see what the figures are like for October, November, December, when the school year has started, and people can, reliably predict whether or not their kids are going to be in school or not, I think you'll see, you know, we'll have better data on stuff. But there is that broader mismatch in the employment market, too, where it's like a lot of jobs that people went to high school or college for and still were like don't quite exist. Whereas industries like construction in particular, as well as a lot of service jobs, are really going begging. And that's partly because we have spent, you know, as part of America's industrial policy, we've spent a lot more time training people for office jobs than for construction jobs. So,
Catherine, you referenced policy choices, and so did everyone did basically already, that contributed to the weirdness that we're experiencing. Can you, so the backdrop of our conversation is the stuff that we've talked about the previous 2 weeks' episodes, which is that Capitol Hill is still theoretically negotiating over a giant infrastructure plan and a giant social spending plan, both combined in the trillions of dollars. Looking at the policy choices that got here and being cognizant of the mistakes, what do you worry about policy choices that we're on the verge of making now? Is there any evidence that we're learning from any lessons from what we've gone through up to this point?
So there's a bunch of stuff in those bills that are still under consideration that basically tilts us more toward Buy American and sort of brings more economic function internal to the U.S. or makes it harder to do business abroad. And I think that is ill-advised at this moment. I can understand why one take on this might be like, well, if we just made everything here at home, we wouldn't have these supply chain problems. But that is, I think,
it works so well for North Korea, right?
Right. That is a deeply misguided theory, which you can look to history and to the present to see why that is not going to work out well. I also think, although I know there are people who spend their entire lives studying this question, and I am certainly not one of them, it seems like it is not the way to go right now to have the federal government essentially, at least partially for their own sake, create massive, massive numbers of jobs digging ditches and building things, when one of the big problems with our economy right now is we don't have enough people to dig ditches and build things. Just on the sort of simplest level, that strikes me as like not the most efficient way to help our economy be strong. And I think, you know, the things that aren't in that bill that really could help with the supply chain issues that we're having right now are our port system is part of our infrastructure. And as far as I know, there is not much in those bills, if anything, to solve some of the problems where the U.S. is really lagging behind the rest of the world. We don't operate our ports 24/7. The unions are disproportionately powerful and govern a lot of what is going on in the nodes of our transportation infrastructure where there is trouble, including in our air travel infrastructure, where, you know, this weekend I went to Nashville to attend the Free Your Future Fest, which was the Students for Liberty conference. And the Nashville airport was a hellscape because Southwest had canceled a day's worth of flights. And while they say that it is not because of a union-driven sick out, there are certainly some reasons to believe that it was. And that again is a product of labor shortages, which are compounded by overpowered unions.
And to be clear, the sick out has to do with upset over vaccine mandates.
Correct, which is like real wheels within wheels, right? So we have Joe Biden, who has, you know, is an old school Democrat, and in that sense, maybe even more pro-union than a lot of the Dems you see around these days, but also is so, you know, so dead set, even after saying that he was probably not empowered to do them. He has now gone all in on doing these slightly backdoor vaccine mandates, which create exactly this problem. It makes it puts employers on the hook for enforcing the federal mandate, and is just naturally going to create this conflict, especially since unions are broadly lining up against those mandates.
Nick, out of deference to your Italian-American heritage on this sacred day, can you tell us, please, about what noted bodybuilder Charles Gasparino wrote about over the weekend having to do with the Federal Reserve and the money printer going burr, which is another aspect of our ongoing
economy? I think we're over that, Matt. I think we're done with the money printer going burr.
Are we? Okay. Well, you know.
I think we got to give it 6 months and then we can bring it back ironically.
Okay. But can you talk?
I want to point out that Columbus, who knew a little thing or two about ships, did not have vaccine mandates, but he was very free with giving out smallpox to everybody that he met on his travels. So he was a giver, not a taker.
And those ports were open 24/7.
Yeah. Yeah. Although then again, you know, as long as we're talking about something like that, you know, venereal disease, syphilis is a new world disease. So, you know, the natives gave as good as they got, really, when you're talking about
that. This right here is what we call victim blaming, I think. There's a term for that.
Victim sharing. It's like an open and equal exchange.
This podcast just turned into a 1970s David Cronenberg film really fast.
Yeah. You have no idea what's about to come out of, or maybe you do, Peter, what's coming out of my stomach.
The bathtub.
No. Orifices.
Videodrome, you know. James Woods has never been more convincing, right? So, Matt, about Charles Gasparino, what he was talking about in the New York Post, keeping it to Italian-Americans. Although I think, like a lot of people, he's faking being Italian because it's cool now to be Italian-American. But
let's not go too far.
He talks about how Jerome Powell, the Fed Reserve Chair, is, you know, trying to taper the massive making of money through asset purchases in the bond market, which is something that the Fed has been doing a long time, you know, and just kind of increasing the amount of money and stuff that's available. And that's pissing off a lot of powerful people because anytime the Fed does anything to tighten the money supply, politicians generally get really freaked out if you're in power, because it tends to the extent that it works or it has an effect or even just as a signal, things start to tighten up. Biden is already extremely unpopular and, you know, for a number of reasons, and these economic issues are not helping him. So if the Fed tightens the money supply, one presumes, you know, that it's going to be something like the impact that Paul Volcker letting the interest rates rise in the late 70s hurt Jimmy Carter. So there's that.
Peter, Catherine was talking about the vaccine mandate, Southwest Airlines thing going on here. I've written about this a little bit. There have been a lot of warnings from people in various sectors when vaccine mandates have gone into effect in healthcare in a lot of states, including New York, teachers and whatnot, and military. I think there's a Drudge Report headline right now that hundreds of thousands of U.S. military are not getting vaccinated, and it could cause these labor shortages. The response to that tends to be, well, we're just talking about, you know, 1 or 2 or 3% of workers in sector X. And so it's, you know, at the end of the day, people are going to get their vaccines and they'll grumble about it, but they're going to do it because, you know, 3% isn't that much. But 3% can be kind of a lot, can't it, in the context of what we're talking about? If 3% of the labor force suddenly decides to not work anymore because of vaccine mandates when they go into effect, wouldn't that be kind of a huge hit on the economy?
Well, I think, you know, the jury is still out on whether or not the vaccine mandate, such that it is the test or vaccine mandate that is going supposedly going to come through an OSHA rule that has not yet been released, is actually going to be a big factor here. But it can't help. And especially in a time where there are already labor shortages, you can't imagine that this is a scenario in which that rule, whatever it ends up saying, is going to be something that is going to make it easier to find workers in this economy.
I found out last night, hanging out with some Frenchies, that the vaccine, the pass sanitaire, right, the vaccine passport in France, is going to be wound down. They have an off-ramp, and that's also happening in Italy, from what I understand. Once vaccinations got to X percent, I think it's 80 in that case, they're like, okay, cool, we're done. And they've been off-ramping also on all kinds of restrictions having to do with schools and things. Imagine that people would feel a lot less clenched up, Catherine, if we had an idea of where X ends, including and especially on vaccine mandates, right? If we get to this level, then we can stop putting this kind of, forcing these kind of conflicts onto people in the workplace or people who are trying to go to a restaurant and such like. Do you get any sense, Catherine, that there is any planned off ramps for such things?
No, I mean, I think, you know, the private sector has figured out that people really respond extremely well to gamifying things, right? Like, you know, how many likes can you get on this post? How, you know, can you, you know, get your 10 punches so you get a free sandwich? Like, this is not a new idea that people like to have goals and a prize at the end. And I think it is actually deeply weird that with our response to the pandemic, we have not harnessed more of the power of that, right? Like, if we all work together and get to definable goal X, you get prize Y, is a thing that Joe Biden could have done. And that also at the state level people could have done, and at the local level people could have done. And I think that would have been highly motivating. Now, you know, if I'm being fair, I think that the trouble is early on, you know, it was not clear what any of those numbers really were, right? I mean, as you know, you and I, Matt, were just like screaming, like begging for certainty around school reopenings. It was a not unreasonable response early on in the pandemic to just say like, wow, this is a new thing and this is hard and we don't know how to set those goals and we don't want to set goals that are the wrong ones and then break our promises. And I do respect that. But we are now like, I am in phase 3 or 10 or whatever phase we are in of the pandemic where I feel like we have all the tools we need to be done with this thing. And we now need to use them in a rational way. And that includes, you know, stuff like setting out end dates and off ramps for all pandemic restrictions. It includes setting, you know, reasonable goals, either, you know, employers or government setting reasonable goals for vaccination. Again, I would like for none of the government based goals to be mandatory, but we have already revealed that we do not have a public health establishment or a presidency that can effectively communicate in a non-coercive way. So that's a shame. But yeah, I would love to see off ramps. I would love to see clear end dates, you know, but then we have on the flip side, we have in some places, I think in New Zealand right now, they just re-locked down to a full lockdown because of a spike in cases. And it's, you know,
and
there,
it was probably
there
like a couple of dozen cases.
And
at
it was
most.
Probably a couple of dozen cases at most. And they're in a what they call, I think, a level 4 lockdown, which is, or they're about to go back into it, which is where you can't even socialize with other families. I mean, it's like a very, very locked down lockdown. So, you know, I think, as I say, I was in Nashville this weekend. It was a reminder that not
the
all
New Zealand of America.
Yeah, exactly the opposite. It was a reminder that not all of America is evenly responding to the pandemic. And oh my God, I've never seen that many bachelorettes, and none of them had a cute little mask that had bride spelled out in rhinestones, y'all. They were just out spitting on each other.
I think Catherine's point about incentives is right. And if you think like me that vaccination is the key to ending the pandemic, that people should be vaccinated, then we had so much money. We have so much money that has been used, that could have been used for incentives to get people vaccinated, right? We spent $6 trillion, or I should say, Congress authorized the spending of something like $6 trillion. And then a lot of it still hasn't been spent. And a lot of it went to states to subsidize their budgets, states that actually had increased tax revenue during the pandemic for a variety of reasons. And so if we'd just taken a tiny percentage of that and said, hey, you know what? We want you to get vaccinated. We'll pay you to do it. That's what we're going to do. We're not going to do all of the other dumb stuff that we're doing, basically providing, you know, billions, if not trillions of dollars for blue states and teachers unions and God knows what else. And just said, look, we'll pay you to get vaccinated. We could have done that. And that would have gotten people vaccinated. And I'm not saying that this is the greatest policy idea or my preferred way of doing things as a libertarian. On the other hand, if that money is out there and being spent, it should be spent on the one thing that we know actually works.
Nick, I'm getting a probably prematurely a lot of kind of 70s vibes coming out of the Biden administration, mm-hmm. Carter vibes. His poll numbers are absolutely tanking already in this. Right. He has a sense of haplessness. About him.
He's going to start talking to Hunter about whether or not nuclear energy is a good idea.
Oh, God. you and I, just in order to check this box, wrote a book about called The Declaration of Independence that used the 70s as a set piece to some degree to say, hey, look, they're actually, well, in the middle of this kind of awful reality and policy that was made in between.
A decade horribilis, Matt.
Yes, but that there were green shoots, you know, at the time of the gas lines, there was a property tax revolt in California. There was all kinds of weird fermentation happening politically.
Fermentation.
Yes, right? Literal.
In the home brewing subculture.
So do you see green shoots in the political system, in the private system? Are there things to look forward to? We both watched George Will give a keynote at Cato, which is a think tank, the other week. And
also a discount women's shoe store, by the way, for those of you who live in the Midwest.
And a hand softener, skin softener. You're soaking in it. But he gave the case for optimism, which it's kind of hard to come by. And so do you have a sense? Are there things that we should be looking for that give us optimism that we might see policy course corrections one day?
You know, that's two things. One is, I think there are reasons for optimism because we are so clearly at the end of something, in the same way that the 70s was the end of many long-term trends and a consensus in American politics that had been in place at least since the 30s. You know, that was when unions realized that whatever you could do, like unions couldn't control the deindustrialization process. They could speed it up, which they did do, and so did management. But that was an era where America stopped, pretending that it could dominate global production of things like cars and steels and whatnot. And as a major dislocation, along with a bunch of cultural trends and social trends, divorce becoming extremely common. But it was also it was a time when a lot of things opened up in terms of lifestyle liberation, feminism, and the gay rights, kind of revolt all came online fully in the 70s, and people were allowed, you ended the decade much freer to live however you wanted than you started. And in many ways, just to dilate a little bit on the 70s, because it always gets a shit deal in economic terms. People's houses, people like Peggy Noonan talked about this, people's houses at the end of the 70s were filled with more stuff because a lot of international trade opened up and suddenly getting cheap stuff from Taiwan as well as China, which was opened up during the 70s and elsewhere. You were able, I know this growing up, lower middle class in New Jersey, by the end of the decade, my brother, my sister, myself, and my parents all had portable TVs in our room, so we didn't have to sit and watch the same shitty show that one person would be able to dictate.
Each got to watch your own shitty shows, which were still pretty shitty at that
terrible,
time.
Yeah, totally terrible, and with awful
That's
reception.
The future.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a lot like today, to be quite honest, but Looking right now, and I'm thinking about a place like New York. New York is a deflated balloon. And the question is, you know, is it actually going to ramp back up to something approaching a pre-pandemic level, or at least Manhattan? And the short answer is probably not in the near term. But what is starting to happen is you just see different types of people starting to wander the streets, and they're not causing crime. I feel a strong sense of potential here, because a lot of old detritus. And again, we need to look at all of these changes in longer term horizons, you know, labor force participation rate, problems with supply chain, you know, these port problems. They should have been addressed after the financial crisis. We had a ton of infrastructure that had to do with ports and roads and rail lines and things like that. Nothing got done. It's a long, slow moving thing that America's airports, our ports, our highways, and our rail lines are shitty compared to the rest of the world because they started using private capital. Maybe it'll jumpstart this kind of stuff finally, because we don't have money left for this type of thing. But more importantly, a lot of old things are dying and a lot of newer things are starting to bubble up.
All right. We're going to continue the economic policy conversation via our listener email of the week in a moment. But first, living in a digital age where your personal data is always under attack, you would think that online privacy was a thing of the past, but it is not. Did you know that there's a better way to protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing your private information? Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws are in force. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other privacy-violating laws. Your email and instant messaging services will be safe from big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, Google. You can take back your privacy and online security today with Secure. Here's how. Visit secure.com. That's S-E-K-U-R.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. So keep them emails pumping to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Justin, who is very nice and writes, "Howdy, esteemed members of the Reasonable and Roundtable." What? "I have observed our country's budgeting process appears to be suboptimal given Congress can't discuss course correction during debt ceiling debates because the money has been spent. Congress can't discuss course correction before spending money because the government might shut down and somehow that's a problem. So the question is, given that this dynamic will not change likely in the foreseeable future, when do each of you foresee the proverbial fiscal can getting kicked off the proverbial fiscal cliff?
Did you write this letter?
I think I even noticed that one.
Did you write this letter?
Resulting in a new fiscal reality being forced on all of us. Peter, you go first.
I just think that the issue here is entitlements. Entitlements, entitlements, entitlements. And so when Congress is debating whether or not to keep the government open, what they're debating is the budget that is the non-entitlement portion of the budget. And the debt limit is just money to keep paying on stuff that we've already borrowed and stuff that's already been spent and has already been debated. But the thing that it doesn't get talked about, the thing that nobody pays attention to, is entitlement spending, because it's spent automatically. Congress doesn't have to do anything when the government shuts down, right? Like, yes, some of the Social Security check writing apparatus does get shut down as part of that sometimes, but like this money just keeps going forever and forever, and Congress never has to think about it or do anything because it just gets spent. And entitlements are the big driver of our debt and deficit problems, and they are increasingly something that both parties just agree, well, we're going to treat them as non-problems. Medicare is one of the big trust funds in Medicare is going to be insolvent during the next presidential term, right? And so it's about 5 years away. And then Social Security will be insolvent in the 2030s. And so at some point, they're going to have to make some decisions. I think they're going to make some bad decisions, as we've talked about before, but they're going to have to make some decisions about how to reset those programs, the funding for them, and whether or not we're going to be able to meet those obligations. And so I think that the the crap will hit the fan at the point that at the point that Medicare can no longer pay all of its obligations. That point is coming very, very soon, and it should be something that Congress and you know, whoever's in the White House is talking about now. Maybe it will be an issue in the next election because, like I said, the next president is going to have to deal with it. But until it is forced upon them, I don't think that anybody wants to make any big decisions.
Catherine, when do you foresee the kicked can hitting the fan?
I always just kind of go all the way to Lionel Shriver's apocalypse or her dystopia in her book The Mandibles, which is basically ask the question, what happens when the U.S. dollar ceases to be the world's reserve currency? That's where my mind goes. Like, when I see in my mind the fiscal can sailing off of the proverbial fiscal cliff, you know, that strikes me as the sort of likely inciting event. Now, I don't think that necessarily there will not be a moment when that happens. Right. It will happen sort of very slowly and then all at once. And I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. The dollar is still. People have many reasons to continue to want to hold dollars to trust that debt held by the U.S. government is going to be serviced and repaid. But that is the thing I think about. It's just, I think entitlements is a huge part of it. But I also think there is a point where, and this is one reason that I worried so much about the Trump presidency, is like there's a point where people just don't trust the United States to basically be chill. That's a very formal technical economic term. But the basic chillness of the United States is, feels wobbly. It feels, in some ways right now, less wobbly than it did 2 years ago. But, that is the thing I am always looking out for. And I think as a policy matter, we've talked many times on this podcast about the fact that Congress has no incentives at all. To fix this. No individual congressman has any reason to try and fix the problem that was, I think, quite correctly outlined in the letter. And so we are going to be sort of buffeted by events and by, semi-random personalities until we either emerge from the darkness or everything goes to hell.
I'm reminded, Matt, that, Jar Jar Binks was a senator, and our own Senate is filled with Jar Jar Binkses. And that I think one of the ways that we're going to see entitlement reform, which I think is tied to, and then the effect of that on the budget is tied to how long the U.S. Remains as the world's reserve currency or how long people have faith in it. You actually have a large number of people in the House and the Senate who are pushing to expand the entitlement state right as it is starting to approach, a hyper, warp speed or whatever of like going off of a fiscal cliff. I don't know what kind of time-space continuum metaphors we want to mangle here, but that will actually speed it up, and the idea of putting everybody on Medicare, of, adding dental and vision and, and maybe sex work. I don't know. It's like they want to fucking expand the social welfare state at the exact moment that it's starting to make things go bankrupt at a quicker and quicker pace. I think, that's the type of thing where it's like Jar Jar who introduces, the resolution to give the emperor or whatever, like special powers. Congress is going to do this for us. I recommend if people are interested in a history of entitlements, The High Cost of Good Intentions, which came out in 2017 by John Kogan, economic historian at the Hoover Institution and at Stanford. It's a fantastic and somewhat depressing book because he charts from even before there was an United States, the Continental Congress had put in kind of entitlement plans in the name of helping poor people or particularly widows of Revolutionary War soldiers. And it just keeps getting worse and worse until it can't anymore.
I think the moment of truth happens only on that day when there's mandatory Social Security cuts, which would be like 6 years from now or something like that.
It's a 2030s for Social Security, but it's coming a lot sooner for Medicare. And when a senior shows up at a hospital and the hospital's like, well, there's a complication here because first of all, we're still dealing with staff shortages from 5 years ago in the post-pandemic labor problems. because of the Thanos snap. And then also, we're not really sure how your bills are going to get paid, so we're not quite sure if we can do this procedure. I mean, that's going to create big problems. Or even just when hospitals are like, we're going to do these procedures, but they basically focus all of their lobbying energy on telling Congress that you need to pay us in full what you have promised us for these procedures. And Congress doesn't have an answer because Medicare doesn't have the trust fund that pays hospitals is insolvent.
But we know the script that is going to be played out both in Medicare, yep, and then more at Social Security, which is going to be, in order to preserve these things, we're going to cut benefits a little bit, we're going to increase payroll taxes, and we're going to expand the amount of money that this all, you know, that the payroll taxes cover, particularly for Social Security. Crisis will be averted for 10 to 15 or 20 years. The real question is, how do we have, you know, there was that Christopher Buckley novel, God, it's got to be 15 years ago now, Boomsday, about, you know, a youth movement that pushes back against Social Security. We need to have an ideology floating in place. This is, you know, what Milton Friedman used to say, is that the whole point of talking about ideas is so that when a crisis happens, something that was politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. And we really need to figure out how to put out there so that when people are grasping at straws and Congress does what everybody knows it's going to do, we actually have an alternative that changes fundamentally. You know, part of getting out of the 20th century is getting out of an entitlement state that is based on kind of Bismarckian social welfare and taxing a lot of people to pay off things for fewer and fewer people. We need to disrupt that in a massive way.
There is this problem, though, right? And this is true in regular life as well as in policymaking, which is that actually we don't make better policy. We don't find a better way forward when we're in the crisis. We find those things when we are in times of plenty, that, you know, when everyone is sort of relaxed and things are going okay, that's the time to make big changes. And unfortunately, it's awfully hard to see how we would be having a moment like that anytime in the near future with respect to, with respect to the federal balance sheet. But I always am skeptical of the once it gets bad enough, there's a breakthrough and then everyone's a libertarian thesis. And
What it is that if we are taking the time now because we have 5 years, you know, for Medicare and, you know, 10 or whatever, 8 years at least to for Social Security, how are the ways that you reframe discussions and start things? Somebody like Andrew Yang, who, you know, for better or for worse, is starting a new party that may not go anywhere. But when you look at the way that the UBI has been injected into policy discussions, that was an idea that started with people like Friedman and the negative income tax in the late 60s and early 70s. It is now a plausible alternative to a whole host of things that's being discussed. And I think I agree with you. You never want to be coming up with everything just as you're going down the drain. But having a coherent set of persuasive and attractive ideas that have been sold to, a willing public or a subsector of that. It might be young people. It might be old people. I'm always amazed at the number of wealthy seniors who will say, and I would take them on, that they don't want to take Social Security. They don't want to take Medicare. They have to enroll in Medicare. It's against the law not to take Medicare. Let's start with them. You know, let's get Mothers Against Drunk Driving, you know, that model, but, you know, rich seniors against fucking Medicare, because they know it's ripping off their kids and their grandkids.
So. That all we have is Abigail Disney out there still doing that same song and dance.
You know, the wrong Disney got frozen. Let's just say that.
Oh, deep thoughts.
Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Peter, why don't you start us off?
I watched No Time to Die, the 25th official James Bond film. So that's 25 since Dr. No in 1962. And just for as useful comparison, there have been 25 Marvel Cinematic Universe films since 2007. So, you know, James Bond is only barely keeping up here. The movie is a little long. It's about 2 hours and 45 minutes, and it has some villain problems, but it's also, I liked it for the most part. It's interesting because it gives Bond something he's never had before, an ending, and this really ends the Daniel Craig era in a very dramatically endy kind of way. And fittingly, for a film that is an ending, it's a look back at the character and his legacy, and a kind of reckoning with who he is and what he's wrought in a way that doesn't give in to the temptation to just make James Bond something different and to say, oh, well, you know what? People have complained that James Bond is a violent, misogynistic white male for forever. We'll make him something other than that. No, he's still that in this movie. But he is now surrounded by a world that has changed and sort of forced to think about what it means to be him, and to what it means to live with that. So it's a pretty good movie. Fans of Daniel Craig, James Bond, I don't think this is the best one, but it is one of the better Daniel Craig, James Bonds, and a pretty good movie overall. It also just looks great. So if you like James Bond films, it's worth seeing.
I watched, and I know Nick did as well, the Netflix special from Dave Chappelle called The Closer. I suspect it was called that because that's supposed to be the last of his current round of Netflix specials. I'm not sure whether that's a contract negotiation, but it feels like the end of a cycle, which is probably for the best, even though I liked it very much. I was worried about it going in because of the way that it was talked about or presented by people who were chattering about it. And I'm not meaning here the various joyless people who write about comedy for left-wing publications. Or not even left, we were the Forbes. This is a Forbes headline. Dave Chappelle's The Closer paints a sad portrait of a declining comedian, says Forbes. I wasn't worried about that. I was just worried that I'd heard that it was just him responding to all of his critics. And that gets dangerously close to Lenny Bruce, you know, reading from his court cases, which is to say not funny. You're super not funny if that's what it was like. But I was happy to see his commitment to being funny. And telling jokes is still there. This sounds stupid, but like I think of comedy as in the way that Gandalf, when he's coming in to see Frodo about the ring at the beginning of Lord of the Rings,
is like, my God.
It's like,
you've been infected.
This is a long-standing.
I had a Frodo wizard lives is never, sticker. Is never late or early, right? He always arrives precisely when he means to.
He screwed up, let's be honest. But he talks about, is it secret? Is it safe? talking about the ring. For me, a comedy is like, is it funny? Is it funny? And is it good? And it's funny and it's good. So you can exhale. I can exhale about that. Other people might disagree. But he's still.
Why would you be upset if Dave Chappelle was just revealed to be a rank misogynist?
I wouldn't be upset.
Okay. But what you're saying, like, you can relax.
No, I can relax that it's funny. That's all I want comedy to be funny. There's a couple of moments in the special where there's a bit of clapter and you go, oh, no, because clapter is the death of comedy in many ways. But also in this case, in both times that it happened, it was the prelude to a particularly like awful and inappropriate and hilarious joke. So it's all good. I think it's an important, everyone's going to exaggerate its importance. Andrew Sullivan has a great piece about it that I think exaggerates its importance.
It's making Andrew rethink the biological limits of blackness or of African-Americans.
I don't even want to begin to go with that, Honora Rodre Hares. Rodre Hares, root of the problem. But
not just boxing.
It's funny. It's a commentary on our times, and I'm kind of glad that it's the last of this cycle, because if he's going to spend every time just sort of chasing the tail of the critics of him talking about transgender issues, it could get old. But it was still very artistically done. A lot of weird callbacks, good storytelling, very funny. And he's basically doing the comedy of social manners in a particular milieu and saying things that are funny, partly because they're kind of true and exaggerated, and also you're not supposed to say a lot of those things. And I think that's very it's very useful, and I hope he takes a nice break and comes back and is funny about other things. But Nick, what do you
think? I liked it a lot, and I think he remains not just the best comedian or long form comedian out there. But also like a legitimately interesting and meaningful and kind of urgent social critic or social commentator. I think, you know, I think that's great. And I felt a bit manipulated by the whole thing, because it starts out with him making a lot of trans jokes, which are kind of both funny and kind of rank, you know, when he starts talking about trans people, trans women's vaginas, and he likens them to the Impossible Burger. And he's like, you know, that's not blood, that's beet juice. It's very funny and very nasty and very mean. There is an attempt in some of what he's doing that is starting to worry me, Matt. And when you say he should take some time off, or, you know, you hope he does, I think that's good to come up with like new material. But there's a kind of sense that he, throughout the special, there are people, and they're either trans women or women, white women, who he kind of ranks on. And he's kind of like, it's always saying that, don't talk to me about anything. I'm a black man. So I, you know, he's the guy who popularized the term like misery Olympics and things like that years ago, and that this was a problem. But he's constantly throwing that down as like the final, you know, a gold coin, saying like, no, nobody has it worse than I do, or the group that I represent. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting, because the group he actually represents now are centimillionaire comedians who can do whatever the fuck they want and have absolute, you know, the absolute right to do everything. And I think that's great. I think he deserves that. He's a fantastic comedian and things like that. But I find it less interesting, because he now is kind of, you know, making solidarity with people that he really has very little in common with. And there is, I would argue, you know, and I think I've said this before, there's a weird creeping anger and hate that is focused on white women, particularly middle-class or college-educated white women, that I, you know, that just strikes, it's creeping in all over, you know, kind of all aspects of popular culture and of culture in general. And I find that troubling, because we, you know, a lot of people are acting as if, you know, the Karen is the absolute wielder of, you know, Thanos-like power. You know, Karen can snap her fingers and then everything, you know, every black man gets lynched, you know, because the cops have been called and things like that. And it's a weird and fucked up kind of tick in contemporary American culture. And I hope that we can figure out how to kind of de-emphasize that, because it seems to me fundamentally wrong, and it allows people to have dumb conversations when we need smarter ones.
Do you guys think that the fact that the most celebrated contemporary stand-up comedian has now devoted himself and his comedy to comedy that is about comedy and about the critics of comedy in a lot of ways, right? Even if he's just making the jokes that you're not supposed to make, right?
Right.
And not specifically addressing his critics and not, you know, reading his hate mail. Do you think that reflects well on the state of comedy? I mean, or what do you think that sort of says on like about comedy itself?
I mean, it's what was the documentary that Ted Balaker made? You know, we can't take a joke. Our ex coworker Michael Moynihan did a piece about trying to deal with, I think it was people who book comedy onto college campuses. And it's a nightmare of, you know, there's a whole bunch of comedians, Chris Rock among them, who say, we just won't go to colleges, forget it. I think Jerry Seinfeld said the same thing. There's obviously, there's obviously a problem in comedy, including that all of the late night comedy shows are deeply unfunny, and their exercises and kind of in-group solidarity, it's just awful. So yeah, it doesn't say anything good, but, it also has created some things that are funny, the reactions to it. It's just that at some point, reactionariness in general in the culture becomes tedious, because you want to live your life and do something else that's just funny on its own.
Yeah, you want to be moving into new territory rather than kind of, you know, closing out the Western Front at the end of the war. But Peter, I think, you know, you raise an interesting question, because I think you could also say that we're more in a moment of kind of metafiction or meta-narrative kind of contemplation in a lot of the arts. You see that in comedy. I think you see it in filmmaking. and TV shows
Bond.
Where there's
that's
a ton
Bond,
of
the
meta
Bond,
stuff.
This Bond yeah. franchise Bond, right? was about what it means to be James Bond in this film in particular.
Right. Yeah. And, and you see that in novels, weirdly, given that the high watermark of kind of metafiction was arguably in the late 80s when a series of, self-styled metafictionists wrote novels about the writing of novels. I'm thinking of people like Thomas Pynchon and William Gass and John Hawkes, and came out with these books that were long awaited and closed out an era. But like most books now are, there's a shift towards autofiction, and it is kind of books about nothing except the act of writing and the writer's kind of thinking or the protagonist type of thinking. So I think it's that we're in a moment aesthetically about that. And that's usually a sign that things have been played out, like the material has been worked over. And one hopes that this is, the kind of, last iterations of this stuff before we start getting into stuff that is just breaking new ground and moving into new territories, I think.
Journalism has this problem too, right?
Absolutely.
Now. I mean, there's a lot of journalism that is about how journalists are being treated and about whether other people get to pretend to be journalists and about who gets to share information and whose information is misinformation.
Or subjective, blah, blah,
there's
blah.
I think journalism is having an umphaloskepticism problem as well.
Catherine, since Nick was talking about hated white ladies, what have you been consuming?
A book about dead white ladies, actually. So right on brand. I read Kat Rosenfield's new novel, which is out tomorrow. It is called No One Will Miss Her. And I got to start out by saying I'm not one of those white ladies that likes murder. There's like the whole like white ladies that like murder podcast thing.
Those white
and
ladies.
I might. There are lots of reasons to think I might be one of those ladies, but it just happens that I'm not. So I don't really like murder. I don't read a lot of thrillers. But I read this book because it's by Kat Rosenfield, who I really do like and who writes for Reason sometimes and is the bomb. And this book is good, my dudes. Here's why it's good. It's sort of like, this is going to sound like an insult, actually, but it's praise. It's like a Hallmark movie in that it's like extremely atmospheric. Like you're immediately smelling the wood smoke of the lake house where the officer is walking up the drive and like, he's not going to find anything good, but it's like a dark through the looking glass Hallmark movie of death. And it's just really well plotted. It is fun to read. And it, unlike so many other books, is set in the real world that contains all of the technologies that we have. I think sometimes you read these kind of like literary novels and they sort of gloss over the existence of Instagram because that's going to be not beautiful or something. And this book just has like Airbnb is just in this book and Instagram is just in this book. And it's it makes it more immediate and more interesting. And I really do recommend it to fans of the genre, but also even skeptics. If you like murder or white ladies, this book could be for you.
I think she's a great writer in a wide variety of genres, including young adult and kind of fantasy or superhero type stuff. She wrote a novel with Stan Lee not too long ago. And she also wrote for, I think, The Spectator, one of the best defenses, a non kind of reactionary defense of why being a cis woman is different than being trans. And it's not nasty or mean, but it's rooted in a kind of physical experience. I think Kat Rosenfield is one of the most interesting kind of novelists, but also commentators around right now.
I do want to register a complaint about her Twitter feed, which is that she is always the person that makes me go figure out what today's stupid Twitter controversy is, because she subtweets today's stupid Twitter controversy all the time. Girlfriend never puts the link in there. And so I'm forced to like Google vague keywords until I find where Jesse Single has like explained it to me. And I resent that, Kat. So please get it together.
She also wrote a great piece recently, and this is enough nice things to say about her. But
she's really kind of an asshole.
talking about kind of social media mob cancel culture stuff, and before you immediately change the channel on reading about that again, unless it's Nick Gillespie, she came up with a really good metaphor having to do with Disney fairies and Brothers Grimm fairies and their role in those stories compared to now. And it's actually very clever and interesting. All right, Nick, what did you consume besides Mr. Chappelle?
I purchased recently Maelstrom, Strom, which is a service that allows you to do batch deletes and other kind of things to your overstuffed electronic mail inbox. And this was something I've been trying for literally decades to get a handle. As somebody who started using email in 1990, I have a lot of emails, and I literally had 1.5 million emails that I was trying to figure out what do I keep and what do I save. And I am down to like 270,000 emails now after about a week to 7 or 8 days.
Congratulations?
Priceless yeah, treasures all.
I mean, it is just, you know, there are many programs like this, and I'm sure some of, you know, I can't speak to all of them, but Maelstrom, which costs, it costs like $80 a year. And, you know, you can cancel it after you reach whatever you want. But $80 a year for normal accounts. And then for me, I had to go to an upgrade because I had more than 250,000 emails that I was trying to manage. And it so it was like $189. But they're very helpful in their customer service. They were like, get down to 250 and then we'll bump you down to the lower level. Et cetera. But it just works really well. It organizes stuff, and you're allowed to you can set up rules and figure out what is stuff that you may want to keep for some stupid reason that, you know, this mass email from, you know, John Perry Barlow in 1996 is meaningful or not. It's fantastic. And it also allows you to do regular kind of upkeep and maintenance. It'll unsubscribe you from lists and delete all the emails that are related to that, et cetera. Maelstrom is like a real game changer for me in terms of, you know, inbox management.
That's all the inbox management we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Please do listen to all of our podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. You can find all those and the Soho Forum. We just had a debate a lot of people are talking about between Scott Horton and Bill Kristol on the Soho Forum debate about foreign policy. That went up, I believe, on Friday. But yeah, go to reason.com/podcasts. And we will see you next week. Have a very happy Indigenous, Columbus, Italian Heritage, and National Coming Out Day. Bye-bye.